This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. My name is Anthony Arnov. I'm an editor at Haymarket Books and a member of Tempest Collective. I'll be chairing this session of Socialism 2024 with Ilan Pappe, 10 Myths About Zionism. Welcome, Ilan. We're especially glad that he was able to get in the country without the level of harassment he experienced when he came to Detroit recently. We encourage folks to make comments and ask questions from the floor when we get to that point of the program. Just please keep your comments brief and definitely under 3 minutes so we can allow the maximum participation. And we'll have a timekeeper who is going to be helping me, who will let you know when you have 30 seconds to wrap up if you've hit 2.5 minutes. I am now very happy to introduce Ilan Pappe, who's professor of history and director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies, University of Exeter. He is also the chair of a new charity, the Nakba Memorial Foundation in Britain, that struggles against Nakba denial. Ilan has written more than 20 books to date, including 3 titles with Haymarket Books, On Palestine and Gaza in Crisis, both with Noam Chomsky, and the soon-to-be-published Palestine in a World on Fire with Catherine Natanel. If you subscribe to the Haymarket Books book club at haymarketbooks.org, you can get a copy of the forthcoming book for free as part of that membership. He is also author of the best-selling The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine and the book from which the title of this session is adapted, 10 Myths About Israel. And I'm very pleased to say that Verso Books, the publisher of 10 Myths About Israel, has just rushed us the new updated edition. So this is an opportunity to get the new updated edition before anyone else. And after this session, Ilan will be up in the book room signing all of his books. So please join me in welcoming Ilan Pappe.
Thank you, Anthony, for your kind introduction. Thank you all for being here. It feels a bit surreal to talk about history at a time when we are all gathered here to think together how to stop the genocide in Gaza and the one that is developing in the West Bank, and how to strategize or help to strategize for the liberation of Palestine. But as I think many of you are aware, the history of the Zionist project in Palestine is a very important entry point for understanding the situation today and for discussing the future. And once we are thinking of extending the network of support for Palestine beyond our usual suspects, beyond the people we have worked for so many years together in the solidarity movement, we still, I'm sure, are aware, about the level of ignorance and misinformation and mythologies that are connected to the way the mainstream media in this country and in the global north in general reports the history of Palestine, the situation in Palestine, and as well as in some very important academic centers, still in courses and modules across the academia in the global north, still the way the history is being told plays an important role in the immunity that Israel is granted by the global north, and particularly by the United States, for its criminal policies on the ground. And it's not enough to defy or even defeat the misinformation and fabrication that goes along with the historical narrative that are being spent in, by the media or by the academia by sound bites. The machinery that produces these misinformed, misguided, and fabricated narratives is a very sophisticated one and includes a lot of important academics and journalists and wordsmiths, people who know how to write and how to talk and how to preach. And in order to challenge them successfully, we need to understand the history of the place, of the Zionist movement, of the Zionist project in a profound way through proper research, through professional historiography, and with the help of those who are decided to devote their life for that kind of research and activity. So I think that their interaction, which was always very important in the left, between academics or intellectuals or educators and activists is something which is highly important for the success of expanding the network of solidarity with Palestine and contributing, be it a modest contribution, to the liberation of Palestine and the decolonization of historical Palestine. The 10 Myths of Israel, the book itself, was actually born out of this rather frustrating engagement I had, not with people in the solidarity movement with Palestine, but whenever I try to expand my dialogue beyond those who are committed or have been committed strongly to Palestine. Whenever you try to expand the network, to try and say, I will talk with some people who seem to be reasonable, educated, have a modicum of decency in them, whose positions on other social and political issues you respect. In fact, some of them are your mentors in certain areas of study or human activity. You encounter this very solid narrative of why there is a conflict in Palestine, what is its origins, why is it continuing, and what is the best way to deal with it. And you understand that even if you had 50 minutes to talk with these people, if they would be patient enough to listen to you, even that would not be enough. That actually only if you can somehow convince them to sit in your class for a whole year, as I suggested the two agents of the Homeland Security in Detroit when they kept teaching me the history of Palestine. I thought that only a year with them, I mean, with these two guys, I probably needed 2 years. You really need a year at least to unpack and challenge the kind of history that maybe for some of you would sound bizarre, but the vast majority still of people who can make a difference in this country to in affecting American policy towards Palestine, the vast majority of the people are still holding on to the myth that we will try to debunk and challenge today. And we can divide these mythologies or myths to ones that come from the past, even the distant past, some that are still with us and relate to a more kind of for contemporary issues, or the present, if you want, and some that are associated with the way people who are in a position to influence policies are talking about the future. And some of these myths about how to engage in a conversation about the future of Palestine have unfortunately emerged in the last year, put forward by the professional side of the Biden administration, and they come under the title of the day after. And the day after, the way it is being articulated, not just by the politicians, by the president, the vice president, or the secretary of state, but if you read more into the kind of more professional papers, policy papers that have been prepared under the title of the day after, mainly for Gaza, but not only for Gaza, for the whole issue of Palestine, you can see that the mythologies that informed the conversation in this country about the future of Israel in Palestine is still the very same conversation, as if the last 9 or 10 months have taught these people nothing about what is wrong with their attitude and their analysis. So the first, probably, and you're familiar, a myth that for many of us would sound maybe ridiculous or obnoxious or unrealistic or untrue or invalid, is still one that you can hear a lot of people repeating in one version or the other. And that's the myth that Palestine was a land without people, waiting for the people without land. And what is important in challenging the first part of this myth, that Palestine was a land without people, is that you don't do it by saying, no, it was. Thank God, for the last 20 or 25 years, very erudite, industrious historians have managed to reconstruct for us the history of Palestine on the eve of the Zionist arrival. And Palestine before the arrival of the Zionists, the early Zionists arrived in Palestine in 1882. Palestine on the eve of the arrival of the Zionists was a place with a vibrant society where people were mostly living in rural areas, but also had some urban centers, which were were organically connected to the rest of the region, which in Arabic was called the Mashrik, that is the Eastern Mediterranean. And the flow of ideas, of culture production, political ideas and platforms included very much Jaffa and Haifa and Jerusalem, as it did Beirut, Damascus, Alexandria, or Cairo. All these cities were interconnected organically in cultural, economic, and social ties. And that's why Palestine was such a vibrant place. The period, and I think some of you know that, in the history of that part of the world, the period that precedes the arrival of the Zionists, namely more or less 1800 to 1882, is called the period of the Renaissance, al-Nahda in Arabic. The Renaissance of which meant, as in anywhere else in the world, when we talk about Renaissance, that is where new ideas are flowing, where people are producing through plays, through fiction, through journalism, and any other kind of cultural media, new works, new interpretation of the reality. And in that particular age, the age of nationalism, it also helps to gel a collective identity and receiving new ideas such as self-determination, liberation, and independence as part of the overall perception of who you are, where you came from, and where you're going to. And this society was on the way, like the other societies around it, on the way towards a challenge period where European imperialism began to replace the Ottoman Empire that ruled that area for 400 years. But with European imperialism came also the good contributions of Europe to that area, as well as the more negative ones. And it's very, very clear, although we are not allowed to write a book in history which says what would have happened if, we always tell our students, don't do that. But actually, we should tell our students to do that because it's very good for one's imagination and understanding alternative developments in history. But it's very clear that without Zionism, there's no reason to believe that Palestine would have not developed like the countries around it, with the same problems and same achievements. And maybe we always like to believe, maybe it would have done even better than its neighbors, given what we think, and I'm totally subjective here, about the quality of the people who lived between the river and the sea on the eve of the arrival of the Zionists. But definitely, this was not an empty land in terms of society, culture, and society, and people. And it's important to stress this point, because I think for quite a lot of liberals around the world, this idea that actually the Jews colonized, or a group of Jews colonized an empty place, makes it easier to defeat any notions that would equate Zionism with colonialism. Because if you colonize an empty space, then it's not really colonialism, just a movement into an empty land. But it was not. And as we know, many settler colonial movements treated lands with indigenous people as empty land. The Zionists have not invented anything new. In fact, they were inspired by those who already preceded them with the same notion that where you have indigenous people, the land is empty. The fact that, for example, it's Oxford University Press, still produces an atlas of the Arab-Israeli conflict by Martin Gilbert, in I think it's the 15th edition or something like that. And it has a cartographic history of Palestine, namely the history of Palestine through maps. And the first map is, of course, Palestine in the biblical times. And then you have Palestine during the Roman times. And then nothing really happens in Palestine until the Crusaders come. And between the Crusaders and the arrival of Zionism, again, there's a black hole. Nothing happened. And this is one of the most important tools for teaching, especially young people, the history of Palestine, a place where a space where nothing happened until the Zionists arrived. And again, comparable to the way some atlases are telling the history of Australia, Americas, and so on. As for the myths of the Zionist movement representing people without land, well, this notion that people of the Jewish faith were a nation and therefore entitled to a nation state, and that nation state had to be the ancient biblical land of Palestine, has been also contested very successfully by professional historians. There is no doubt that there were Jews in the late 19th century who decided to redefine Judaism as nationalism. That's an historical fact. But that doesn't mean that this is something that, A, most of the Jews at the time accepted. In fact, not. It was a minority position. And it was transformed into a powerful movement, not because a lot of Jews were recruited behind the idea that Judaism is actually not a religion, but a nationalism. They were recruited actually by a lot of, by two groups, I would say, who were, I call them selective anti-Semites, and I'll explain what I mean by that. One group, which is still very important today in sustaining Zionist mythologies, are the Christian fundamentalists, a very important stream in evangelical Christianity that long before any Jew thought about Zionism were already the early Zionists, dating back to the 17th century and 18th century. Why do I call them selective anti-Semites? Because they developed a dogma, which I think some of you are familiar with, the restorationist dogma, which believes that the Jews, the return of the Jews, so to speak, to the Holy Land, namely to Palestine, would precipitate the second coming of the Messiah, the resurrection of the dead, and the beginning of the 1,000 years of Christ's rule on the globe. Now, why was it selective anti-Semitic? Because, in a way, what motivated the less pious members of this movement, what really attracted them to the idea, was that was a way, if you want, an elegant way of getting rid of the Jews and getting back the only Jew you really wanted, Jesus Christ. It's a double bill for a fanatic Christian fundamentalist. Couldn't be better. And they were very, very active on both sides of the Atlantic in pushing Jewish intellectuals to stand behind the idea that not only Judaism is nationalism, but it had to be fulfilled in Palestine. Because as some of you would know, even the founding father of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, was not entirely sure that Palestine was the only possible destination for modernizing the Jews as a nation instead of a faith. He was willing to consider Uganda, for instance, when the British offered that, and some of his colleagues were even touring places here in the United States and in South America, in Azerbaijan, looking for places where maybe Zionism could be fulfilled. But in order to make sure that the new Jewish movement does not give up on the idea of Palestine as an exclusive destination for implementing Zionism as nationalism, the Christian Zionists were very important in pressuring the Zionist movement not to change course and to hone on Palestine as the main destination. And these Christian Zionists were holding important political, economic, and cultural positions on both sides of the Atlantic. Now, another myth that, of course, is immediately connected with this and is very relevant to our day is to equate Zionism with Judaism and therefore equate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. And I think many of you were accused in your time of being anti-Semites because you declared yourself to be anti-Zionist, or if you are Jews yourself, or being self-hating Jew. Now, again, the problem with challenging this kind of equation is that you need some space and some patience of your interlocutors to understand that this is the wrong equation, that Judaism is religion and Zionism is ideology, and there are a lot of Jews who are not Zionists, and there are quite a lot of non-Jews who are Zionists, which shows you that this is an ideology that is beyond one religion or the other. But you will have to recount the history of the Zionist movement, how it becomes, how it transformed from a very marginal idea into a more powerful force. And it doesn't happen by itself. There is a very strong lobby that makes sure that Zionism becomes more and more equated with Judaism. And you need a strong lobby and you need a very devoted advocacy, because for many people this does not sound very reasonable and valid. And at the heart of all of this is something that I think quite a lot of people ignore in history. And that is the fact that the leading or the leaders of what is called Anglo-Zionism or American Zionism, that is the leader of Jewish communities who devoted their energy for the sake of Zionism, have never themselves thought of emigrating to Palestine. And if you look at the way the American Zionist movement developed, you can see that at the kind of a more hidden level of motivation was the fear that without Palestine there would be an influx of poor Jews from Russia into the United States. And that's one of the main reasons that some American Jews supported Zionism. Of course, they didn't say it aloud, because that was not a very nice thing to say for supporting the colonization of Palestine. They support the colonization of Palestine because it was the homeland of the Jewish people. But not in America. There was, of course, another problem, that if Judaism is nationalism, there was always the danger of being accused of dual loyalty as well. So Jewish nationalism was fine for people in Romania, in Russia, but not for Jews in America. Because if Jews in America would say that their nationality is Jewish, then they are open to accusation of dual loyalty. And the same is true about British Jews and French Jews and so on. So this is a complex relationship that shows you that Zionism, more than anything else, contributed to anti-Semitism rather than being the panacea for anti-Semitism. And anything that happened in the last year or two just proves the point that this is what its main effect is on the relationship of the Jewish communities in the world with each other and with the other societies. Now, if we move closer to our time, and we want to debunk mythologies that are still at the heart of the way mainstream media, mainstream politics, and mainstream academia in this country interpret Israel and Palestine, which also feeds their ideas for the best solution in the future, we go back to 1948. And it's incredible to see, even in the left in America, and not only in America, that for many years, probably unintentionally, people were ignoring 1948 as the beginning of the story, or as a pivotal moment in the story. Anyone who worked endlessly and religiously for a two-state solution, and I was there myself, I will have to admit, in my youth, was ignoring the importance of the 1948 and the Nakba for the history and present and future of Palestine. And even when you heard the Secretary General of the United Nations very bravely and courageously, and should be commended for it, when he said we should understand that the events of the 7th of October did not happen in a vacuum. And he immediately says, what I mean is that what happens on the 7th of October happened because of 56 years of occupation. No, my dear Secretary General. It happened because of 76 years of occupation, not 56 years. This kind of history that is not being told or is not being told properly is important, because you have to talk about what happened in 1948 as an act of ethnic cleansing, as a crime against humanity. And you have to understand the connection, for instance, between what goes on in the Gaza Strip and the events of 1948. For instance, there was no Gaza Strip before the Nakba. The Nakba produced the Gaza Strip. Gaza was a cosmopolitan town on the Via Maris, the road from Alexandria to Alexandretta in Turkey, where a lot of people and goods and ideas were passing. It was organically connected to Jaffa in the north, to Beersheba in the east, and it was part of a district that included many villages and small towns. Now, in 1948, when the Zionist forces began to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians, they pushed the Palestinians in the north to Lebanon and Syria, the Palestinians in the middle to Jordan, or what became the West Bank, and they wanted to push the Palestinians in the south to Egypt, to the Sinai Peninsula. But like today, Egypt then as well refused to allow Palestinian refugees to cross the border. So Israel had, the young Israel had a problem. So they decided to create this rectangle that you can see on the map as the Gaza Strip, as a huge refugee camp, as a receptor for the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians that they expelled during the second half of 1948 from the south of Palestine into Gaza, making the Gaza Strip the biggest refugee camp on earth. And the last wave of villages that were forcefully removed and its house burned and demolished were the villages that are today, on the ruins of these villages today, are the Jewish-Israeli settlements that were attacked by on the 7th of October. So you need to know that history for understanding what was going on also on the 7th of October and not just in the Gaza Strip itself. 70% of the people who live today in Gaza, 70% are 1948 refugees. And many of them are from villages and towns which are very near to the Strip itself. Not to mention the fact that the international indifference to the ethnic cleansing in 1948 provided encouragement to Israel to continue the ethnic cleansing in other means after 1948. Because after all, in 1948, Israel succeeded, in inverted comma, only to ethnically cleanse half of Palestine's population. And many of the refugees remained in Palestine itself, in refugee camps in the Gaza Strip and refugee camps in the West Bank. And many others remained in refugee camps near Palestine. So in order to complete the incomplete ethnic cleansing of 1948, Israel continued ethnically cleansing Palestinians, first from inside Israel until 1967, and then after occupying the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, not on the same magnitude as it expelled them during 1948, in a more incremental way, but nonetheless, hundreds of thousands, to my account, about 450,000 Palestinians were expelled from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip between 1967 until the 7th of October, 2023. And I think what I see today is an Israeli decision to use another method in order to complete the ethnic cleansing of 1948. And that's the method of genocide. And the first phase of genocide finished in the Gaza Strip. We don't know the numbers. People are talking about 40,000. But what we hear from United Nations officials about the many bodies under the rubbles, we're probably talking about 200,000 people. And now Israel is moving into a genocidal operation in the West Bank under the pretext of another mythology, that they're actually preempting an Iranian proxy war against Israel. But this is just a pretext for beginning a genocidal policy toward the Palestinians in the West Bank. And I'm afraid that the next station after that are the Palestinian citizens of Israel. This is a messianic Zionist, or as Nur Masalha calls it rightly, a messianic neo-Zionist government that believes it has an historical opportunity to complete the total de-Arabization of Palestine from the river to the sea. And this opportunity will not repeat itself. and therefore, contrary to the way the American administration looks at the situation, are very much in favor of escalating the situation into a regional war, because like the Christian fundamentalists, they believe that a huge explosion, violent explosion, a doomsday war, Armageddon kind of war, is part of the divine scheme that opens the way for a different kind of period in the future. And we should take seriously these notions and the way they are being translated into policies on the ground. I would like to finish by talking a little bit about the mythologies that are connected to the future. And of course, there are many more. I haven't been able in 35 minutes to cover them all, and I hope we'll cover some of it in our discussion. But I think that one of the major challenges we have in trying to spread the word or to inject a new, an old new kind of dictionary or vocabulary into the way we would like people to talk about Palestine, about the situation today and about our hopes for the future. And some of that language, I'm very happy to say, has been adopted also by the solidarity movement here, by the encampments. And when people ask me what is the difference between the solidarity movement with the Palestinians in the 70s and the one that emerged in the last 10 or 11 months, I say that I think that more clearly the necessary vocabulary is being now adopted and spoken naturally, if these kids were born with this kind of dictionary. And that's very encouraging to hear that. And that is a non-nonsense approach to Zionism as a colonialist project, jettisoning the conversation about peace, replacing it with conversation about decolonization, challenging the Israeli notion of being the only democracy in the Middle East by referring it to an apartheid state, settler colonial apartheid state, and by adopting a vision that is so beautifully, of course, encapsulated in the slogan, Palestine should be free from the river to the sea. I think this is something that is still a far cry from the way mainstream media, mainstream academia, and mainstream politics are talking about Palestine, especially, as I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, all this conversation on the day after is based on the two-state solution, the kind of Bat Nustan that was... The idea is to create another Bantustan in the Gaza Strip, similar to the one in the West Bank, and somehow hope that this is going to work. God knows where did they find the source of inspiration to think that it should work, on what basis, what books are they reading, who are they consulting? I have no idea, because so much nonsense being written recently on this. That is, maybe it's something to do with the politicians of our time, without generalizing too much, but I don't remember such a period in history where politicians were such of low caliber. In every country. I mean, even people I disliked 20 years ago, I respected as leaders. We have now something which is really below the par. Whatever it is, if we find a way of injecting this conversation with the right terminology, I think we are going to be able to defeat the mythology both in our academic works, in our activism, in our conversation, and making sure that this is, and insist that this is the language we should use. We don't use conflict, we don't use peace, we don't use two-state. Two-state solution has been dead for so many years. It's lying in the morgue. Everybody is afraid to have the funeral, but it's time to bring it into an honorary burial so that we can all have a closure and move on. I'll finish, and hope that there's much more to be said later, that there was kind of a humorous moment in my conversation with the two agents in Detroit when they asked me, do I believe in the slogan that Palestine should be free from the river to the sea? I said to them that everywhere there's a land between two sources of water, people should be free. But one of the guys wanted to show me that he did listen in his geography classes, and he said, what about Bulgaria? I remember he said. I said, okay, everywhere between any two sources of water, I'm sure there is, I haven't looked at the map, people should be free. I really believe that it's time that we will use the same language in our academic courses in universities, stop teaching Palestine in political science department that deal with conflict management and conflict resolution, move it to modules for decolonization, genocide studies, anti-colonialism, and let's defeat the oxymoron, academic courage. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.